You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
Glad you've all made it here this morning. The heat, of course, is very oppressive at the moment, so we're all relieved that it's a morning session rather than an afternoon session. Just to explain a little bit the format of today's meeting, we have two panel sessions. There is some overlap in the topics between the two sessions, but we have a very, very distinguished panel in both sessions. The first panel will look more, the overarching theme of the first panel will really be the security dimension to the energy question, which also encompasses climate increasingly seen as a security issue. And the second session will focus more on the balance of power, the new emerging balance of power in the global energy market, trade implications, and so forth. The way we are going to structure each of these panels is that there will be a half hour from each session lasts an hour and a half. We will begin with a half hour of 5 to 6 minute presentations from each of the panelists. We'll then have a short panel debate of no more than 15 minutes on one or two of the key points raised. And then we will open it up to the floor so that we get as much time as possible for interactive debate with you in the audience. So let me introduce the key themes, really, and then I'll introduce the panel and we can get down to it. The title of the two sessions, the overarching title, is The New Geopolitics of Energy. And I think the word new is very important in this respect, because we're living through a time of great change and huge disruption. I think if there's one word that covers all of the dimensions of global energy markets and the European energy market at the moment, it really is disruption. Those of my vintage, I grew up mainly in the 70s and 80s, the global energy market was a more easily understandable market. The global energy supply was dominated by fossil fuels, it still is, but less so than it was, and certainly in future will be even less so. Oil was hugely important, remains hugely important, and OPEC, hugely important. All of those points still stand today, but we have some huge disruption going on. And of course, on the demand side, it was the OECD countries that were really driving global energy demand. That is certainly no longer the case. Just a few points of some of the major disruptive factors that we're going to be talking about today in the two sessions. I would highlight in particular, number one, the rise of shale oil and shale gas in the United States and the very disruptive impact that is having on the global oil and gas industry, and we'll certainly get into that topic in the second session in particular. Secondly, climate policy and the need to address the climate crisis that we are living through, and that future generations in particular will have to deal with the consequences of that. Very important climate change summit at the end of this year, of course, in Paris. So that is a very important backdrop to almost everything that we will be talking about today. Thirdly, the disruptive impact of technology, renewable technology in particular, which is having a huge impact in Europe and right across the world. And given the speed at which the cost of renewable energy technologies is falling, that is going to pose increasingly a very big challenge to the fossil fuel industry. And of course, the ever-present threat, and it's here in the title, geopolitics. Two very big issues just in the news at the moment are the situation in the east of Europe with Ukraine and Russia. And also, of course, at this very moment, we have the talks between the P5+1 and Iran in Vienna that could also lead to a very changed environment in the global oil market and global energy market. So those are the kinds of topics we're going to be addressing today in the two sessions. We're really also interested in finding out who are the winners and losers. That can be in terms of countries, it can be in terms of technologies, and it can be in terms of companies. But I think what is the leitmotif of all of this is that we are living through a time of very disruptive change, and As the famous Italian novelist put it in the 19th century, if you want things to stay the same, then things are going to have to change. And I think that's a very apposite leitmotif to have as we are going through this. Now, on the first panel this morning, I'm joined by a very eminent group, beginning with Elmar Brok, who's just arrived, and who is the head of the Energy Security, is the chair of the European Parliament Committee on Foreign Affairs, and also a trustee of the Friends of Europe. Michael Rühler, head of the Energy Security Section at the at NATO, obviously looking in particular at energy security challenges. To my left, Joan McNaughton, very well-known figure in the world of energy and climate, and now executive chair of the World Energy Trilemma at the World Energy Council. Denis Simonneau, member of the executive committee and director for European and international relations of ENGIE. And Alar Olyom, advisor for North Africa, Middle East, the Arabian Peninsula, Iran and Iraq at the European External Action Service. My name is Mark Lewis. I am the chief energy economist at Kepler Cheuvreux. I was formerly the head of energy research at Deutsche Bank for many years, and it's an enormous privilege for me to chair and moderate this session this morning. So without further ado, I'd like to kick off with the comments from the panel. And Michael, if I could ask you to begin with your thoughts on these questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation. You quoted an Italian author. Let me quote an Israeli humorist who once said that God had two major catastrophes for mankind. One was marriage and the other was tax, because both force you to cheat. Since I work on the energy field, I feel that this could easily be the third catastrophe that God had given us, because the amount of cheating that is going on in terms of how energy and security, how economic interests are intertwined with state interests, how geopolitical interests are intertwined with seemingly objective analysis and so forth. There's a lot of cheating in this field, and from someone who comes from hard security, this is a pretty tough environment, actually, I have to say. But still, I think one can identify a couple of lessons from the events over the last several years, both for Europe and more globally, that have that are interesting for a security organization like NATO. And when I start with Europe, then of course the one of the lessons we have learned and relearned over the last several years, and especially in the current crisis, is that energy can be a matter of national security. Whether we like to admit this or not, whether we like to keep energy a purely economic subject, which ideally it should be, I think we have to admit energy is a matter of national security as well. We also have made, I think, or drawn another lesson too much dependence on Russia can be a strategic liability. I say can be because not everybody will probably share this view. It depends also where you are on the map. Interdependence is not always a two-way street. If the producer can go longer without revenues, then the consumer can go without gas, then you have an asymmetry, which is very, very difficult to manage. With respect to Russia, I think this idea of changing Russia through trade has only partially been successful. The EU, and this is the good news, I think, is increasingly playing an important role as an energy player in its own right. And the reverse flow to Ukraine is one example. The lawsuits against Gazprom and of course, the moves towards the energy union, I think they show some sort of interesting development the emergence of a new player. Globally, I think you mentioned already the shale gas revolution. Interesting to see that technology can be a geopolitical game changer, especially on energy extraction. Very interesting. We also see, I think, with great concern, especially when you look to Asia, that energy and resource issues are increasingly intertwined with territorial disputes. And I think that gives cause for concern. We also see new energy alignments, if you think of Russia and China, but I think they're still very ambiguous in terms of how deep they are and how serious they are and how profitable they are. And we also see continuing tensions. You mentioned the Iran negotiations, tensions between non-proliferation and energy. I think a hard security guy will look at the nuclear question. An energy guy will look at Iranians' oil and gas. And this could lead to sometimes very different conclusions. What are the consequences? I think in principle for the European consumer overall, the consequences of what happened recently or the last several years are more or less positive, flexible markets, lower prices. But I think we need to have a much greater awareness or generate a much greater awareness about the nexus between energy resources and security. I think this is still not fully studied, at least not in our organization. We also need to look at other security effects of energy changes. If you go to a low carbon economy, smart grids become more interesting. They become they are more vulnerable to cyber attacks. So we need to look at the links between these different developments. We need to look at the climate angle much more seriously, especially about the security implications of climate change, which in NATO we have not done so far really in earnest, and I think it's time to do that. And beyond Paris, not just because it's interesting right now. And of course we need to look at the question at which all of you are looking, what happens if the winners of yesterday, the producing countries, fossil fuel producing countries, become the losers of tomorrow? And instability in these countries will grow because of the low oil price environment. What does this mean for security if these countries become less stable? The shift towards LNG, transported over large distances by sea, which increases the issue of maritime security. And also, last point, the need to look at how can we make our armed forces more energy efficient, both for operational reasons, but also to lower the environmental footprint of the military, because the military should not be a bystander in the debate on climate change and energy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. And you stuck absolutely exactly to the time limit. That's very impressive. And also, thank you very much for some very thought-provoking and provocative comments. I think the purpose this morning, the Friends of Europe's debates, we really like to encourage provocative, not polemical, but provocative discussions, and Michael's got us off to a very good start there, and in particular when you concluded by saying NATO needs to look at its the armed forces need to look at their energy consumption. Remember, the United States Army United States military is the single largest consumer of oil on the planet, I think. Well, Elmer Brock, could I ask you now to give your thoughts on this?
Thank you very much. A few ideas as we discuss it in European Parliament. First of all, I think we have to learn again in Europe that energy is not just economics. It was always a strategic goal, a tool. And this was forgotten in the time where energy was safe and was not so much used as we believed for political reasons. But I think Putin's speeches in 2012 made it very clear, as he became the last time president, that for him energy policy is a political instrument. He made it very clear from the very beginning. And this was not taken seriously. And we see it now again as he has stopped now in the last days the energy, the gas flow to Ukraine. It's always the same game. I think most important is that we develop this idea of the energy union, of the European Union, which will bring us together and especially had the aim to strengthen the power of the consumer. And I believe if that way of interconnectivity we have achieved partly, I think well, not all the successes are a great success, now 50% of the gas of Ukraine, what Ukraine needs, can be supplied from the European Union. Makes huge difference, not solve the problem totally, but makes a huge difference. And this, I think, it's quite an important point. If we see how much Russia relies on selling gas to Europe, then they cannot stop the whole gas supply for Europe because it meets bankruptcy for Russia. And the more we stick together, and they cannot stop a supply to one country because then this country gets gas from the other countries, I think that makes a big difference. But what we have to do also in this question to come to a joint bargaining power, which means that he cannot put political prices in this way. It's nowadays even more difficult for him because of the fall of the oil prices. But you see that Russia and Gazprom has with every different European country different prices. And I think here we should come to a better situation. They had not a competition between the Europeans and the bargaining with Russia. I believe also that we need more to use our competition rules, the competition law in Europe when it comes to influence from foreign energy suppliers. Ownership of the network, the producer should not be the owner of the network, should not have a chance to go to the end consumer and all that. I believe there should be no major difference that foreign suppliers have more rights than our own companies. And here I think the possibilities of the competition law is because of political reasons not fully used until now. And I think here might be much more possibilities. But all that shows to me that we have a classical problem. We have seen it again in now more or less doubling of the potential of Nord Stream. Countries like Russia, but also others, have state-owned, more or less state-owned companies. But our understanding is that we work in most of our countries with private companies. How can you and we cannot and want not to use private companies in the same way as a political tool, as countries like Russia can visit a state-owned company. Because to have competition is one of our tools to create values. And how can we have a situation that there is not on one side a clear strategic planning where every part of its politics, security policy, economic interest, put in one strategy, when we are our free market economies cannot do that. And I think, how can we overcome the disadvantages of that without destroying our free market orientation? And I think this will be one of the really important questions. It's a joke if I see, for example, that we tried everything to avoid South Stream. What then was Nabucco killed, partly by the European countries, but also by political pressure from certain countries. And then German companies, suddenly we in politics knew nothing about it, just heard that there's agreement of German private companies with Gazprom to fill that gap in such a deal. And at the same time, last year, a German company sold her full gas network to Gazprom. This, I think, has to discuss also in the security context, which makes me nervous. For sure, diversification, I have not explained that, and I see that John Boehner, for example, was last weekend in Lithuania to open the LNG harbor there. So you see, we see also not just economic interest, but also here via the diversification question, the situation that the United States will play via shale gas an important role. And we do not know what it has an impact on diversification if we would be ready and we all would be ready to have a nuclear deal with Iran, because that would open even more the markets, because we will get more possibilities to diverse our imports when fully the Iranian potential is on the market. That might also change the course of this, perhaps this week, the landscape, that question. Last point. Energy and security policy made me, a German Christian Democrat and conservative, agree. Because I believe the strengthening of renewables and the policy of energy efficiency, it's important. If I see the figures, for example, the potential of energy efficiency, for example, it means potentials of whole pipelines, which we can avoid. And therefore, to discuss this policy in our countries, if it's economically sound, that the question of renewable energy and energy efficiency is part of security policy, not just anymore, just a green political goal. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. That's a very important point you raised there, Elmar, at the end. I mean, and throughout your comments, renewables are disruptive to fossil fuels in the context of a climate policy. But they're also a decentralized form of electricity generation, and I think that's a very disruptive impact as well, and can help with clearly with addressing the security of supply issue, because we, as Europeans, we import the vast majority of our fossil fuel energy, but we have huge potential to generate energy from renewables, and we'll talk more about that in the debate. Joan, if I may hand over to you, because I think you're going to talk a bit more specifically about the climate dimension to all of this.
Yes, thank you very much, Mark. Morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much to Friends of Europe for giving me this opportunity to contribute. What I'd like to say is that you can't look at the supply of energy or the issue of energy security without also looking at the issues of affordability and access to energy for the 1.1 billion who don't have access to electricity, the 3 billion who still have no clean cooking facilities, and therefore that kills more people than AIDS, malaria and TB combined. And sustainability, the climate change issue. And I would say that I'm executive chair of the World Energy Trilemma, which looks at meeting these three goals, but our analysis of 129 countries' energy policies shows that you neglect one of those goals at your peril, and then you will be playing catch-up. So while you will prioritise according to your national needs and the circumstances at the time, in the end, you have to look at all three goals if you're going to have the right kind of energy and if you're going to have the right quality of life for your people. Access to energy and climate change, I think, are very intimately interconnected. First of all, perhaps if the developing world thought we were really serious about dealing with the access to energy issue, we might deal with some of the objections to a climate change deal, which have been coming very much from that quarter. Access to energy would obviously increase energy use, but the International Energy Agency has said that it would have a negligible impact on overall CO2 emissions and a negligible impact on the dynamics of energy and supply globally and also on price. The impact of climate change and the economic deprivation from not having access to energy are both huge drivers of migration. What could be more in our self-interest than to tackle those two, given the pressures that we face from migration? And believe me, I think you ain't seen nothing yet if we don't tackle the impact of drought in sub-Saharan Africa, the economic deprivation there. We need investment to drive access to energy over and above what's planned, perhaps $450 billion, just to get universal electricity in urban areas. So I think that's a priority. The second point I want to make is around these changing dynamics of energy supply and demand. All the growth in demand is coming from the non-OECD countries. OECD is reducing. But if we think about what one of the issues has been recently, it's all around this price volatility. And that low price scenario really has very significant geopolitical implications for instability in the Middle East in particular. I mean, there's one estimate that the average break-even price globally for oil exporters is above $100 a barrel. And when you look at the differences between high-cost and low-cost basins and those people who are making new investments, that becomes even more significant. A third of discoveries have been in sub-Saharan Africa in the last 5 years. They've invested very heavily. In fact, two-thirds of their investment is in resources for export. Are their expectations going to be dashed by a low oil price? Is that going to contribute to yet more instability? Yet again, is Africa going to be too late to the party? My third point is about managing the transition as we move towards a low carbon economy. And most countries now, the big countries, have submitted their commitments in advance of the climate conference in Paris. And while it's not going to be enough to meet the 2-degree target, it's far more than I think any of us would have expected this time last year. But, you know, as well as the goals, we have to think about the risks of managing the transition. As we move to more intermittent renewables, interconnectivity, and I'm glad the European Union is leading the way here, interconnectivity increases, but with that comes increasing vulnerability, particularly to cyber threats, but also to different expectations, procedures, standards, and so on. And we're trying to run the old system and the new system together, and that creates a risk of its own, because if we focus too much on the one, we'll have problems for the other. So what to do? The policymakers need to get much, much more familiar with understanding the dynamics of changing supply and demand, and in particular, how fast might demand destruction for fossil fuels impact on the producers? Is it going to start impacting on investment? And will that happen in a way that might leave us exposed when the demand path isn't falling as quickly as some people may expect? And given that we're going to be dependent on traditional sources of fossil fuels for a long time to come. Secondly, you have to pay attention to all the developments and not just energy policy. So issues around pricing, trade barriers, and the impact of the commitments on demand. And finally, the point I've just made, we must think about the process of transition and how well we manage that, as well as our destination and where we want to be with a low-carbon economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joan. And I think that links very nicely into Denis's contribution, because one of the things we haven't really got into yet is how businesses that are in the midst of this energy transition you were referring to, Joan, how they're facing up to this challenge, how the pricing signals that we have. Elmar referred to the importance of, ideally, free market-driven energy market, but of course there are these constraints that make it difficult. But Denis, if you could tell us how a major European and international energy company is facing this multitude of challenges, and what you think policymakers need to do to make the transition as smooth as possible whilst respecting all of these security dimensions at the same time.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Friends of Europe, for this invitation. So I represent ENGIE, a company in electricity, gas and energy services. I wanted to say that I'm fully in line with what you said, John, in terms of the structural changes that we observe in the energy market, and I will develop a little bit on that. For us, we agree on the fact that we are living a moment when there are so many changes in the business of energy that the companies have to change as well. Let me just mention the structural changes that you just spoken about. I would add the geographical or the geopolitical issues that you will probably raise in a second. But simply, if we look at the situation since 2009, you know, we faced the first crisis between Ukraine and Russia. We had Fukushima. We had then the Arab Springs. And we had now a new, bigger crisis between Ukraine and Russia. So simply in 5 to 6 years. Let me also mention the technological changes that we are facing. And, you know, yesterday ENGIE signed an agreement with Solaire Direct, which is the first producer of solar energy in France and in different countries. We definitely believe that renewables, and in particular solar energy, is going to be more and more important in the energy mix. So what we think is that we are living an energy transition, and usually Gérard Mestrallet, our CEO, is presenting the energy transition like the 4D. The first D is digitalization. You know, we are living in an era where information technologies are more and more important in the energy business. Smart grids, smart meters, you know about that. The second D is decentralization. You know, so far we had big power plants producing energy for industry and residential consumers. Now we are moving to more and more decentralized way of producing energy. The third one, is decarbonization. As you know, and it's connected to climate change naturally. We are looking for new ways of developing energy, producing energy without CO2 emission, without the different gas emissions. The fourth one is, as far as Europe is concerned, the diminution of demand. You know, we had, we always mentioned the peak oil, you know, and so the peak oil is always 40 years before us. But in terms of power generation, we had a peak of production in 2008 within the European Union. Since 2008, we are decreasing the production, and Elmar Brok is perfectly right. Energy efficiency is playing a role. It's not only the crisis, the economic crisis has a role, for sure, but energy efficiency is playing a role as well. So, because of this energy transition that we are facing, we think that the energy companies have to change. And so that's the reason why we not only change our name from GDF Suez to ENGIE, but we are changing our organization as well. We want to be more connected to the territories, more connected to the clients, more connected to the countries. And so we had five big branches, electricity in Europe, electricity international level, GNL and exploration production of gas, infrastructure and energy services. Those five branches will disappear, and we will have 24 different entities connected to the different territories and the different continents. And so what we think is the fact that because of this energy transition, we should work more and more together the different sources of production and energy services. You know, we cannot develop energy services apart from the power generation. And we have to include all the different sources. We think that renewables are very important, as I said, but we think that gas is a good combination with renewable as well. So we will continue to develop the gas production and the gas value chain in our company. The second point, as I said, is that we must pay more attention to technologies. And we support, in that sense, the fact that the energy union should definitely develop a R&D package. We have Horizon 2020, we have the Juncker plan that could be useful as well, but we definitely think that research and development should have a bigger place in our budget at the EU level. If you look at the US, for instance, the Department of Energy is one of the biggest sources of technologies in the US. If you look at Japan today, since Fukushima, Japan is looking at many, many new technologies to replace, in a way, what is happening in the nuclear energy. Last but not least, we think that the energy companies should continue to develop their international development. As I said, there is a situation in the European Union where we have a decreasing demand. But if you look at emerging countries, the demand is huge and is increasing very fast. And if you look at the US, I mean, because of shale gas and shale oil, there is a totally different situation. The last point I wanted to mention is that energy companies have to change, but the public policy and the public diplomacy should adapt to that as well. And so that's why we took this initiative around Jérôme Estrallet to have 11 CEOs of the biggest energy companies within Europe to create the Magritte group. And this group was complaining about the current energy policy of the European Union, but made some proposals to, you know, move in the correct direction. I will not develop on that, but just a few points. Having signals on the CO2 price, because for having clear investments, we should know where we are going in terms of CO2. Look at all the debates today around coal. I mean, there are a lot of complaints about coal power generation, power plants today. The second issue is research and development. I mentioned that. The third one is definitely security of supply. And I think that my neighbor will develop on that. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Denis. Some very interesting points there. R&D is one I want to pick up on afterwards. Alar, We've talked mainly so far from a European perspective. Your area of expertise is the Middle East and North Africa. How do you think the very challenging and quickly changing dynamics of that region, what are the implications of that for European energy policy and European energy security?
Thank you, Mark, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Actually, I will approach that in the end, but I've prepared some remarks generally on Europe. But I'd like to start actually by taking up on what you asked us to do before coming into this room, and that was to be contradictory and critical and try to provoke some argument. First of all, let me just question the title of this session, New Geopolitics, Winners and Losers. As an Estonian and a former Estonian diplomat, having lived through the period of the early 1990s, I can tell you that the geopolitics of energy is not very new. When we started the foreign ministry after regaining independence in 1991, that winter of 91-92, Russia reduced drastically its supply of gas to Estonia. So the main issue working in the foreign ministry was not if you had a corner office, rather if your office was on the north side of the building or the south side of the building. If you were on the north side, you had to wear extra underwear and even gloves to keep your hands from freezing when they were working on the keyboards. So when I came to Brussels, I first started working in the commission in DG RELEX in February of 2006, and people were scratching their heads. They were saying, this is a wake-up call. And actually, this was the first crisis with Ukraine. It was 2006, not 2009, as you said. And I thought, well, this is not very new. Why are you only waking up now? In fact, this has been behavior that we have seen from Russia from the beginning. So I would not say that there has been a paradigmatic shift. Rather, it is a change in context. And the fact that Europe has, and all of Europe has by now become conscious of this, is a new element. But the behavior of Russia with regard to the politicization of energy supply has not changed over 25 years. That's my first point. And the second, regarding winners and losers, I think in energy politics, as it was pointed out by several of the speakers, it's an extremely complex sphere, and it's very difficult to see black and white. I mean, in any issue, even let's take this example of Russian reduction of gas supply. Of course, they are losing money, but it's for political effect. So we lost in terms of the comfort of our citizens, the security of supply, but they also lost in terms of their earnings of gas. So I think there's always a necessity to look at the gray zones. It's never a black and white. There's always, on any energy question, people who are winning and losing in both respects. And I think that's important to keep in mind. If I may, though, I'd just make a few short points about why the geopolitics of energy is important for the EU. First of all, let's remind ourselves that the EU is very special in the world and that we are the largest importer of energy in the world. More than 50% of our energy needs are met by imports. This means over 1 billion daily, almost 400 billion annually, we expend on energy import. Therefore, geopolitics of energy is something that we cannot ignore. We have to know about it, we have to analyze it properly, we have to manage it properly. The first way to deal with that is what was mentioned by our speaker from the European Parliament, Elmar Brok, the energy union that is doing our homework to make sure that we have a free market for energy within Europe, that the power of the consumer, as Elmar Brok had pointed out, is really leveraged as much as possible with regard to suppliers. And I would argue also, with the European model, firstly, internally, is to de-link politics from energy, to make energy subject to market rules, market logic to rules and regulations, as Elmar Brok was also saying on the issue of competition. And as the third point, I would say to extend this same logic globally to ensure that energy is subject to transparent, coherent, consistent rules globally, and that means where I come in, I think my institution comes in energy diplomacy and focusing on the multilateral aspects to modernize the energy charter, to work on both bilateral and multilateral trade agreements with the WTO initiatives in the G7 and G20 and so on. We can go on those later if you like. I would just say a few words about what is a new development. The ES itself is still very much a young enterprise, having started just 4 years ago. But we have now a competence on energy diplomacy, both within the ES and in a network of energy diplomats with the member states. And there was a first discussion just earlier summer in June in the Foreign Affairs Council, led by my boss, the High Representative Federica Mogherini, on some of the precepts of energy diplomacy. And I see my time is up, but I'll just give the headlines. Four of these I'll just name quickly, and I can go into them later in more detail if you like. First of all is to strengthen the strategic guidance through regular high-level engagement. That means that the foreign ministers agree to keep this on the agenda, and this is an accomplishment in itself. Secondly, as I already intimated, to establish energy cooperation and dialogues with important producing and transit countries. We can say Algeria, Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan in the south, also with transit states or regions like Ukraine, Turkey, and regional players like the U.S. and China. Also, with a perspective to the future, to reframe the energy relationship with Russia. Thirdly, it's to support efforts, as I said, to enhance global energy architecture and multilateral initiatives. And fourthly, and perhaps most importantly here, especially as a diplomat from the ES, is to strengthen our common messages and energy diplomacy capacities. I mentioned that we have this energy diplomacy network. Now we have a commitment by the foreign ministers to keep it on the agenda, but we have to keep on message. It's not about having just one voice. It's about having one message, many voices. We have 28 voices plus the European institutions. It's important that we have common narratives and common messages on the key foreign policy challenges relating to the geopolitics of energy. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Almar. Well, I'll open this up to the floor very shortly. I just, pulling together the different strands that we've been discussing across the panel, it seems to me one aspect of this that we've not really discussed, but that links all of these threads together, whether we're talking about the security dimension, security of supply, but also the broader meanings of security that Joan was referring to, the migrant crisis and so on, the climate crisis, and also, as Almar said, the economics, the Europe's dependence on imported energy. It seems to me the key is really one of the most important keys for Europe in particular will be becoming a global leader in energy storage. And Michael, you mentioned, and this draws on Denis' point about research and development and greater cooperation between the public and private sector on research and development. And you said in your concluding remark about NATO needing to do more on energy efficiency and so on. I'm just wondering if there's any way in which the US, through NATO, looking at the security challenge from Russia and so on, is thinking, doing joined up thinking on the energy side and saying, well, if Europe, with all its renewable energy potential, if we can get big breakthroughs in storage, this is an area that could pay off on multiple levels from an economic, security, and climate perspective. Is there joined up thinking going on R&D between the Atlantic powers?
Not in NATO. NATO is not the former.
Of course not. But
well, if we are at the very at the very beginning of a discussion of energy of security implications of energy developments, we are not in policy setting or making. That is something that the European Union or the European Union in conjunction with the United States can do. But that's not what we can do. When we speak of research and development, then it really is a very narrow focus on. Let's say energy efficiency in the military. In other words, how do you bring in renewables, for example, in advancing military operations, so you don't have to refuel them as refuel. Let's say camps as often. So this is on a level that is completely different.
Of course,
from the big strategic picture we're talking about.
Yeah, no, I was really referring to the point that Denis made about the Department of Energy in the U.S. is very actively involved in R&D, and I'm just wondering, given the huge what's at stake strategically here, whether there is scope going forward. Perhaps NATO is not the best vehicle for that, I understand that, but that there should be much greater technology transfer between and within the NATO countries, member countries.
Well, I think that the Europeans sometimes take their cues nationally from what's going on in the United States. But I haven't seen really that much of interaction in terms of technology transfer in this realm. In addition, of course, and others may say more about this, if you see the different, let's say, political cultures in Europe and America just say the word fracking, and you have very different reactions to this. So I think there is the way in which we in Europe use technology is sometimes quite different from the way new technologies are applied in the United States. So that's quite two different cultures in my view.
Joan, you wanted to...
Yes, I did really, because I think it's obviously really important in terms of collaboration on research, and others may want to say more about that, particularly with Horizon 2020 and the Juncker Plan and so forth. But there's another issue, which is around collaboration on resilience. I was co-author of a report by Sinopia 18 months, 2 years ago, and one of the issues we pointed to was the need for far more collaboration at times of stress. Now, that has been picked up in relation to transport of gas, but I'm not sure that we yet have the sophistication of arrangements for mutual support in the gas sphere as we do on oil. I mean, we learnt the hard way in the 70s that we had to have collaboration in supporting other OECD countries, mutual support on oil disruptions. But I don't think we've yet really taken that to the next level in relation to gas, although the European Commission has tried to help with getting much better information about supply and demand on gas. We still don't have that formal requirement for minimum stock levels coming to each other's aid. It would be slightly more difficult to do it globally, but we could certainly think about how to do that at the European Union level.
Yeah, to continue on the same line, let me mention a few topics on which I think that the European Union could play a role in terms of research and development in energy. You must take into account that today, one of the biggest programs is ITER, you know, this nuclear program. ITER is fine, I have no problem with that, but ITER is for the children of the children of our children. So we think that we have today to choose some programs that are far more operational in the short term. Let me take a few examples. You mentioned storage of electricity, for sure. I mean, you see what is happening with a company like Tesla today in the US. So where is the European company on that issue? Nowhere, okay? So if you look at small-scale LNG, gas, if you speak about gas, you know, small-scale LNG is developing LNG for the trucks, for the bus, for the vessels, and even for cars. I mean, we can develop a program for what we call gas natural vehicles or for electric vehicles. I mean, there are some programs from certain, I mean, automotive companies within Europe, but there is no common program within the European Union to develop electric cars or gas vehicles. Third example is what we can do on CCS. You know, we spoke about CCS for long, expecting a very high price of CO2. With a price of 4 euros today per ton, nobody is talking about CCS anymore. But we need CCS. We need CCS because we're going to continue to have fossil fuels in the energy mix in the future. And last but not least, I think that we should also work on certain issues like biomass, what we call methanization, you know, using all the different sources that we have through agricultural policy and these kind of things. And we should also look at what we call maritime sources of energy. I mean, the European Union can do a lot on all these topics with some money. And we have some money, but we should spend it in the correct programs. Thank you.
Absolutely. I mean, Elmer, does that worry you that Europe seems to be, when you look at the United States, falling behind on this key issue of energy storage, that all of the dynamism appears to be on the US side? And do you think that this is an area public and private sectors should be doing more collaborative work on in Europe?
I said that before. We have to find a way that we combine more this free market and at the same time the state's strategic interests, and how we can have more consideration of strategic interest in our economic considerations. President Obama stopped 2 years ago, if I remember rightly, that wind energy park was sold to China, Chinese companies, because of national security reasons. These considerations we do not have. Do not make it an anti-Russian discussion here now, but this is not just towards Russia, it's only this example, or in this case it was China. So I believe we have to clarify our thinking that. At the same time, we have to use more the possibilities of the internal market and the industrial policy within the internal market and also research questions combined with economic interest and put that circular into that. We are on a way to do that something, but I have not a feeling that it's really thought through as a strategy. It's their good case, their good case, but not a real combination, but we are on a way to go there. Then we have negative discussions, for example, of what I can understand. That is LNG. You cannot have LNG because of the environmental impacts in intensely, densely populated areas as you can have it in other areas. And there we have different opinions in our member countries. In Germany, most of the part of Germany will get never the support to have fracking there. In Poland, different other thoughts about that because of different reasons. And this, I think, it's also one of the situations we have to see and where we have to come around, but we need to support our people in that question. The one point I would like to mention still in that context is that our energy policy has also to use more this question of proper research. That, I think, is one of the main possibilities the European Union can do, so that we not control everything, but that we can give incentives for new ideas how to go forward. And that is, I think, one of the main possibilities the Commission can do. And I have a feeling that since Commissioner Oettinger was in that portfolio, but now if we have the Sefcovic and Caneta, we have thoughts about that, to do more in that direction.
Omar, did you want to come in on this point specifically, or no? Okay, good. Well, I think that set the scene very nicely for a conversation with the floor. So anybody who's got a question, if you could raise your hand. I suggest the most effective way of doing this would be for me to take initially 5 questions and select which members of the panelists are best positioned to answer them. When you ask your question, could you please identify yourself and your organization or your affiliation? And we are on Chatham House rules here today, so that's just important to have in mind. So, yes, I have a question over here on the left-hand side.
Thank you. Robert Fanaplas, European Association for Engineers. I'm really surprised when I hear all of you, how many competencies, so dispersed over how many layers and organizations and so on. And, for example, in European Commission, how many DGs are concerned with energy and where are the results? When I see the DOE in America as a powerful tool for R&D and so on, new technologies, we do not have this in Europe. It's very important to have a structured, centralized, big organization, like also the American military, to organize this new approach to energy. And a good example is a European boycott of Russia. You see, in the meantime, Monsieur de Margerie crashing his plane in Moscow airport, the Germans laying a Baltic or third Baltic pipe, and then Royal Dutch Shell making huge agreements with Putin to organize energy policy in Russia. We miss all that, discipline, concentration, and so on. Thank you.
Okay. That was more a comment than a question, I think. I saw there was a hand up over here.
But it's also more a comment than a question. Do you want me to...
Well, no, absolutely,
okay.
Please, yes.
Thank you.
No, it's not a...
My name is Furfari. I am from European Commission and Free University of Brussels. The title of our conference is The New Energy Situation. I think that we should say a new energy situation. Since the Versailles Treaty of 1919, energy policy has always changed and will continue to change. The problem is that we are not always very well prepared for that. Mr. Lewis, you start very rightly saying that at the beginning, we are living a disruptive impact of technology, and you had particularly in renewable energy. I think that the chaos that we have in the Middle East, while the price of oil is collapsing, is not due to the 2% of renewable energy in the world. It's due to the fact that there is a really disruptive change in the way we produce oil and gas, and not just shale gas and shale oil. The real revolution is in conventional oil and gas. Rovuma in Mozambique, Papua New Guinea, Papua, Australia, Israel, all those fields are just conventional fields. And the real change is over there. The problem is that we have think in 1989 that we do not need anymore to develop research and development in oil and gas. When I joined the Commission 33 years ago, we had a wonderful program called Oil and Gas Demonstration Program. This program has been able to develop the technologies to develop offshore production, particularly in the North Sea. And then in 89, the Parliament decided that we do not need that anymore, and we dropped completely the program. The consequence is that all technology now on oil and gas is in the end of USA. It's a strategic mistake, unfortunately. And as I'm Italian, I would like to say that the Italian author we mentioned at the beginning is Tommaso di Lampedusa.
That's right.
In the Gattopardo. And when he say that everything has to change, we are trying to change everything, but one thing we will not change is that people need badly energy. And not only here in Europe, but particularly in Africa, as you say, we have 1.2 billion people in Africa which badly need energy. Energy, first of all, is physics. We forget that. Energy is physics. Energy is the notion of work. If you want to work, you need energy. More people in the world wanting to work will need more energy. We should stop dreaming that we will be able to drop the energy demand very soon in the world.
Okay, thank you. I have a question there, or a hand up in the middle there at the back, and then one here at the front on the left-hand side, and one there.
Thank you. I am Louis-Victor Brille from the European Commission, Directorate General for Research and Innovation. I'm responsible for international cooperation in the Directorate in charge of energy. Just I want to say a few words and ask you questions to brilliant panelists. I have appreciated very much the diversity of opinion and experience. We have in the European Union this energy union recently adopted, which is our new framework. Five dimensions, security of supply is one of them, but research and innovation is another of them. I would like to have from you, what is your opinion, the link between security of supply, which is obvious when we speak about oil, gas, and so on, and technology development, which is, I would say, the next step, the steps which will come in 10, 20 or more years. Having in mind that this transition we have to do heavily depends on our ability, let's say, to have or to master these technologies through the research and development program. And just for answering some concern, I would like just to suggest those who are interested to have a look on the work programs of Horizon 2020 already decided and closed for the years 2014 and 2015. You will see what kind of subjects are addressed. Really speaking, and I stop here, We have divided the research program in two sides, the side of generation of energy and the side of uses of energy, including storage. Thank you very much.
Okay, sorry. So just to clarify, if I understand your question correctly, you want to, the panel to address the question of the link between security of supply and research policies, technology development, etc. Absolutely. Okay. There was a question here at the front.
Thank you very much. Gio Arnigo from JETRO, Japan External Trade Organization. And two questions. And the first question is, I was a bit amazed that all the panel did not speak about nuclear in the role of energy security and climate change, in particular in Europe. So any of you could answer to this question, I'd very much welcome that. And the second question is related to the previous question, that is the balance between the support to renewables and R&D policies, because many European countries are spending a huge amount of money in the form of direct indirect subsidy to the current renewable energy technologies. And but in order to cope with long-term emission reductions, we need completely innovative technologies that need a huge amount of financial resources for R&D. So is there any argument which could shift the focus from supporting to current renewable energy to future innovative technologies?
Okay, and there was a question here, and then we'll go to the panel.
Thank you. My name is Pierre Fabek. I'm an independent energy consultant, and I worked 15 years for GDF Suez before. Mister, you just raised a point I was wanting to raise. My question to the panel was, we have spoken this morning about energy security. We have spoken a lot about CO2, and nobody in the speakers raised the issue of nuclear power. So I was really surprised that this is a very important topic, and it was not raised. So it was really my question. Thank you.
Okay. Well, since we've had two questions on nuclear, why don't we begin with that? Joan, you're well positioned to comment on that. How do you see the role of nuclear in Europe and the world more broadly going forward?
Thank you, Mark. A lot of really interesting points raised, and I'd love to comment on many more. In relation to nuclear specifically, I think it's really important to remember that you can't meet your CO2 goals at an affordable cost without both nuclear and carbon capture and storage, which Denis mentioned. But both of those issues raise concerns of public acceptance in some countries, and particularly after the tragedy at Fukushima. So I think the place we are now in Europe, which is that individual states are at liberty to develop nuclear, is probably as far as we can go. I'm conscious that last time I read it, the Austrians were thinking of challenging the right of the UK to build a nuclear power station, which seems to me bizarre. I think in terms of public acceptance, we have to keep working on confidence. We have to have confidence that the regulatory regime is really fit for purpose. That will help to inspire confidence. And public acceptance of nuclear, according to some survey work we did in the UK, where we moved from a small majority against nuclear to a majority in favour, public confidence has helped if people understand what it is that nuclear is delivering. And actually, the Russian actions in relation to Ukraine and then Belarus helped enormously in moving the needle of public opinion there, but also the understanding of the contribution it will make to tackling climate change. And there's some very interesting survey work showing people's reactions. So why we have nuclear, energy security and climate change, And if we can get the new build right, it should contribute to affordability, but we're struggling there. But secondly, we have to have confidence in the way it's regulated.
Yeah. Denis, you wanted to say something on this. And to Joan's point, you as a representative of a major company making huge investments where there's competition within your company for capital all the time, given what Joan said about we're struggling building new nuclear plants at an affordable price, but to say the least, you know, we've got massive cost overruns, time overruns on the two projects that are being built at the moment, complications with Hinkley Point in the UK, as mm-hmm. as Joan was saying. From an investment point of view of the companies, how risky does it look to you, and how comfortable are you as a company investing in nuclear?
Yeah, thank you. As you know, ENGIE is producing nuclear energy, especially in Belgium. We have 7 reactors in Belgium. We are not in Flamanville. We are not in Olkiluoto.
No.
But we are in Belgium with some difficulties in Belgium, I must tell you. Why? I would say I agree. The advantages of nuclear energy were, first, sustainability because of the limited emission of gas and CO2 in particular. The second advantage was security of supply. There is no real problems of having uranium for the power plants, even though it is moving a little bit on that matter as well. And the third issue was price. So far, nuclear energy was very cheap, but it's not the case anymore. It's not the case anymore. We should be aware of that. Why? Because of Fukushima, I think that the rules of safety and security now in a nuclear project, a greenfield project, a new project, are so high. The expectation from the safety authorities are so high that we are facing a critical situation. And that's precisely what is happening here in Belgium, not on a new project, but on old power plants that, you know, in Doel 3 and Tihange 2, we are facing a situation where, because of very strict programs of control of the power plants, the safety authority of Belgium said, you know, we cannot continue to use those reactors till we get some new information. And it is the case for months and months. I observe that the exactly same machines are working today in France, in the US, and in other countries without any problem. But that's the end of my observation. What I want to say is that nuclear energy for us is part of the mix. We are doing nuclear energy in Belgium. We have 2 big projects, one in Turkey, one in the UK. But my point is that today, without the support of the states, you know, in the UK, we can do nuclear energy because of the contract for difference system, which is a support, a kind of subsidies given by the state to the nuclear energy. If you look at the situation on Eastern Europe today, it's impossible to develop economically any nuclear power plant in the eastern part of Europe because we don't have this system of subsidies. And the only company looking at some opportunities in Eastern Europe is Rosatom, the Russian company, because Russia is saying we will pay everything, we'll do everything. We're going to see. But that's what they are saying. So for me, there is a real problem today in terms of the competitivity, you know, of nuclear energy within the mix.
Absolutely. Michael, you wanted to comment on this.
By definition, a personal comment, because we're not dealing at NATO with this stuff directly, but I think there is a strange dichotomy between the discussion in Europe about nuclear and the rest of the world. And I think in Europe we tended to, many of us at least tended to, I think, somewhat overreact to Fukushima. Now sort of, I think, looking, sobering down a little bit, especially when the climate issue comes into play. What we completely often forget here is that outside of Europe, nuclear is still a serious option. And I just was in Jordan a few weeks ago, and if you are in a country that has no natural resources to produce energy indigenously, then you look at nuclear through a different lens. But this also means, of course, that and another point, of course, that there are new vendors coming online. There are new countries are becoming suppliers of nuclear power plants, and this raises, I think, 2 problems. aside from the storage of the waste. One is the proliferation risks, the nuclear proliferation risks, because any country that has a nuclear power plant could at least try to use it for things other than energy production. And second, of course, security standards, because outside of Europe, I think the standards are often not treated as seriously as we do it here. So nuclear is still there, and it still has positive and negative connotations. But in Europe, the discussion has become very Fukushima-centered, and I think that's not very healthy.
Elmar, did you want to say something on nuclear?
That is true. I agree that for climate change, nuclear power, if nothing happens with the nuclear power, and CO2 storage would be helpful. But on the other side, many people believe that the storage of nuclear waste and CO2 is a danger for future generations. And this, I think, leads us to a situation that in many countries there's not a political consensus to go in such technologies. And that's very different in Europe. But we have to face it and have to take it into account, because if that is not such a consensus in our societies, we cannot do that. And I have to look for other possibilities. The German government even has decided last night to stay with it, zero to nuclear energy, and has decided, because of climate change, to close a lot of coal power plants. So our possibilities to be economically sane and at the same time look into the climate change question is quite difficult. But we have to sue, and therefore I believe that this question of further R&D in that question, also in future technologies, is very much important to look for other cleaner possibilities. But because of that might be a weakness of the European energy strategy. We have the energy mix is national responsibility. There's no possibility, because of these different political positions in our societies, in the different countries, to come to a policy of a joint energy mix. And I think that it's very much important. But give me a last point, because I have shortly to leave. We have to see that questions also what is talked about, a question here about is private companies. And I believe that the possibility to do most of that via state companies will lead also to the situation that this might get a question of economically healthy developments. If I see, for example, what Gazprom, because of political reasons, had to do to make that energy deal with China, the cost of the pipelines, the prices which were agreed, I must say that also because of a political will, the economic basis of such companies are damaged. And therefore, to put that, that the energy security question is a dominating factor, do not include the economic impact of such decisions, has to be taken also into account. And I believe at the end of a way to have the right mixture to talk about more possibilities to have a control in that matter, but not a decisive decision in every detail. What I believe is what we should do in Europe in order to come more to these joint positions when it comes to energy security, that we have to develop a new information and consultation scheme for companies in that with politics. When I hear that, for example, in these deals I mentioned, political leaderships of a country has heard nothing that such a plan is existent and that such things are done, then we have a problem. And I think here to have such an information consultation duty of companies in that way towards Europe would be, I think, an important point, that on that way we can combine more this economic freedom with the aim of have more agreed energy strategy positions for energy security. And perhaps that might be a way to try something about that, so that we can have a discussion with just company what is worthwhile to do.
Thank you very much. I'm very struck here, but my day-to-day job really involves talking to institutional investors who are managing billions and billions and billions of euros and investing that money in energy markets. I deal specifically with energy investors. I come back to this point, and it's in direct response to the question about research and development and technology development. Energy storage is really what most investors at the moment looking at energy markets are most concerned about. They think that that could be really not only a big solution for European society, global society, dealing with climate crisis, dealing with numerous dimensions of the topics we've been discussing this morning, but also will have huge implications for which companies emerge as the winners or losers. And it seems to me, really, on this specific point of research and development technology, thank you, Elmar. I understand Elmar has to leave early. Thank you very much for your contribution. Energy storage is where the next big breakthrough has to come, and this is where so many people are spending so much time thinking about it, but it's how we get the breakthrough, and that's why R&D comes back. But I wanted to bring Almar in on this point, because Almar, with your expertise both from a European perspective and the Middle East and North Africa, Joan and Denis have talked about CCS as a topic that seems to have dropped off the radar. Another topic that's dropped off the radar completely is the Desertec project, the idea that Europe could be importing solar power from North Africa. Now, we all understand the huge political challenge that that represents, but when you really think, if you just forget the politics for a moment and think about the sense this would make on so many levels, is that really a project that is just simply never going to be able to be developed, or given the breakthroughs in technology, isn't that something we should be thinking about still on a medium to long-term basis, if we're genuinely, really, to address these numerous crises, migrants? Joan mentioned specifically North Africa and the migrant crisis. I'm just curious your view on that in particular, because nobody's talking about that anymore. And yet, as Denis said, Engie has yesterday just bought a solar company. The cost of solar power is falling very dramatically. We're just not making use of this resource on anything like the scale we should be doing.
Actually, it's too bad that Elmar Brok left, because the last time I heard a discussion on Desertec was in the European Parliament. And there, of course, the problems and issues with regard to Desertec were quite evident already, and it's true that it seems to have fallen off the radar screen. But maybe I can come at this from a bit of a broader angle, and that is that the countries that would be most engaged with Desertec from the southern side are in an area which even 2 years ago when we had that discussion in the European Parliament looked much more stable, much more open for trade and investment, and having especially infrastructure, which is long-term investment, seem to be a safer bet. So I think it is, in my view, as a non-expert, from what I know, Desertec makes a lot of sense, especially for countries that have no indigenous proven resources to develop solar energy, and for export to Europe, it makes a lot of sense. But even for a country like Algeria, which is blessed with huge resources in the fossil fuel side, if this transition to a carbon-free economy goes forward, then it would not make sense either, even for a country like Algeria, to stay aside. So in a long-term perspective, I think there is a future. Short-term, perhaps it's economically not viable. And I think the main issue that we have to resolve in the short-term is to stabilize the region. I mean, with Libya imploding, with Egypt becoming more unstable by the day, Tunisia, even, you know, the star pupil of the Arab Spring, it's also, as we saw recently with the attacks in Sousse, very vulnerable, very fragile. Morocco is not very often mentioned in this context, and I think Morocco is probably also worth mentioning here as a successful case of our engagement with North Africa, also in the area of solar. Recently there has been new projects partly financed by the EU, opened in Morocco, and they are very seriously engaged with that. They're also looking at, you know, possible new fossil fuel developments, but certainly they are approaching it from a diversification approach, and this is very much welcome.
Yes, I want to bring Joan in, but I just want to make a comment based on what you said to our colleague who made the intervention earlier about the fall in the price of oil has got nothing to do with the renewable revolution and so on. Clearly, on one level, that's factually correct. I think it's arguable, though, and I pick up on this point because of what Alma just said about Algeria. These countries that have both tremendous fossil fuel resources and amazing solar capabilities, there is a school of thought which says one of the reasons Saudi Arabia has changed its policy and is not cutting supply in order to boost prices is because they want to prolong their dominance within the oil market, because they're quite frankly concerned that the longer term prospects for oil in the global energy mix are under threat from climate policy, from the renewables revolution, and so on. So I think whilst on one level I accept what you're saying, on another level you can read it that they're thinking long term here and how they best manage their own energy transition. But Joan, you wanted to come in.
It's partly to that point, and it is very noticeable. Last time I was in Abu Dhabi some weeks ago, and I was amazed at the difference from just a year, 2 years ago, in the emphasis on renewables and energy efficiency. And the same goes for Saudi. I mean, countries which a few years back, all they were thinking about was their fossil fuel, arguing against the need for action on CO2, have now switched. I mean, it is really quite remarkable. And that's partly about keeping available resources for export, but it's also partly about diversification and increasing their own security, and it does respond to the drop in price, in solar in particular. But I wanted to pick up on this point around innovation in technologies and the debate that we've been having. I mean, two or three different comments around the need for more research and development. And I'm sorry that Elmer Brock has gone, because I think I heard him say that, you know, very concerned about leaving this to the market, and that you have to have very strong state actors investing in R&D. Well, you know, the shale revolution didn't come about because of what the US Department of Energy was doing. It came about because market players saw a potential, saw that the risk-reward equation, in their view, was right, and then carried on honing the technology until it became viable commercially. It wasn't that the technology didn't exist. It existed, but it didn't exist to do it well in the shale space, as it were. And I think the challenge is actually to think about those areas where you're not going to get the private sector to be able to move forward. And I think CCS and nuclear are probably good examples of that, where you need a lot of state input because the upfront cost is so huge, the risk-reward equation just doesn't stack up for individual companies. But that doesn't mean that all R&D needs to be state-sponsored. And in fact, you'll get more innovation if you get the right support measures. In the States, they've got a lot of very good tax credits for R&D. You get the right support measures and the right medium to long-term price signals, which Denis mentioned in his opening remarks. So I think the judgment has to be, you know, where does the state have to act, and where is it better to unleash the innovation in the market, particularly because the market's better at saying, well, that one's not working very well, drop that and move on to the next thing.
I wanted just to say one word very, very shortly on security of supply, because somebody raised this issue. And usually when we speak about security of supply, we think about gas, which is true. But I want to mention that there is a problem in electricity power generation as well within Europe. I mean, that's a fact that since we have developed with subsidies a lot of renewables and giving access, priority access to renewables on the grid, we have closed a lot of CCGT, meaning gas power plant. If you take the 11 companies of the Magritte group, we have closed altogether 50,000 megawatts.
So it's a destruction of value. Well, too bad for those companies, you can say that. But it's also a risk for the security of supply in terms of power generation for Europe. And if you add the difficulties that we are facing on nuclear energy, not only in Belgium, but in other member states, so adding all these things, we are facing a situation very, very critical now. That's why we are asking for capacity mechanism, you know, a way to support significant capacity of supply in case of peak demand, because we know that renewables is not a peak demand adapted way of producing energy. So I just wanted to raise this point because usually we speak about gas but not about power generation. Thank you.
Okay, well, I think unfortunately we're running out of time here, and I want people to get properly watered in particular during the coffee break, given the heat. But to conclude with a question to each member of the panel, and from your own particular vantage point, whatever area you focus on, given all the disruptive changes we've been talking about, who do you think will be the winners and the losers from this very turbulent time in the global energy market and through the transition? Michael, if I could begin with you.
I still hope that the winner will be the consumer, because I think we have a better situation now for the consumer than we've had in a long, long time. The loser will be, I presume, the traditional energy producers, because they, most of them have, Russia is the most extreme example, because most of them have failed to diversify their economies. And these rent systems are now, I think, seriously challenged.
Absolutely. Rents under attack from the disruptive impact of new technologies and so forth. Joan, what would you say?
I think if we don't get the investment regime right, we'll all be the losers. The investment regime for fossil fuel investment for the medium future, because the unconventional sources will tail off late in the 2020s. And a lot of investment's been cancelled this year. I mean, all capital programs have been slashed in exploration and production. And yet, between 60 and 80% of our energy use in 2050 is projected to be fossil fuel. I mean, you can argue about whether it should be or not, but, you know, that seems to be a consensus. I think in getting the investment regime right, we also need to think about getting the transition right, because if we go through high-cost pathways, we actually cause people to think that we can't move to a low-carbon economy without damaging our energy security and our prosperity. And that's simply not true. You know, the costs have come down very significantly. But if we apply them in a way that strands assets, it's not just the companies. I mean, the companies, and the money comes from the shareholder, the consumer, and the taxpayer. You know, it's us. So I think we have to get the investment regime right for the transition and to ensure we have continued investment in the right way. And the best way to do that is to have some clear strategies, some good price signals in all the different markets, including carbon.
Denis?
Yes, I would say that the winner should be the European economy. But let me say that I think that among the winners, there will be some companies with a lot of innovation, a lot of flexibility, a lot of international exposure. And to tell you the truth, when the President François Hollande, few months ago or few years ago, mentioned the Airbus de l'énergie, he should have thought at that time about GDF Suez and now ENGIE, because we think that we are the real Airbus of energy. Thank you.
I already said that I don't really like this black and white division between winners and losers, but I would venture in this area, and I would focus on a question which I haven't touched on yet, and that is climate change. And we're looking at perhaps not a train wreck, but certainly a big disappointment in Paris with the next climate change conference. Certainly, I think this is one area that we have to see is ensuring not only for our children, but the coming generations, that the planet will not be the loser from a failure of our diplomats, from our national and international leaders to come to an agreement to share the burden of the transition and to manage it in such a way that it will be equitable, as was pointed out by Joan McNaughton here. I completely agree with what you said in the beginning about bringing the poor countries on board, and this has been one of the big issues in discussions with China as well. I mean, about the historical equity, you know, of having pollution fueling growth and being able to see that in a much broader, even historical perspective. So I would hope very much that the winner will be the planet and not the opposite.
Absolutely, and that's a very good and rousing note to end upon. So could you all join me, please, in thanking the panel for their contribution this morning, and then we'll break for coffee. Thank you very much.